One of the great things, one of the many great things of Coast to Coast is you get to listen to and interact with major guests who are the leaders in their own areas of expertise. And you've got one tonight, Robert Schock, Egyptologist, just a true expert in what he does, noted author and researcher, several of his books, Forgotten Civilization, Pyramid Quest, and so many more. We're going to be talking about one of his new works that will be coming out in a few months. It's about the Sphinx, origins of the Sphinx. He's next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you and Robert Schock back with us, full-time faculty member at Boston University. He earned his PhD in geology and geophysics at Yale. He's been instrumental in spurring renewed attention to the interrelationships between geological and astronomical phenomena, natural catastrophes, early history of civilization. He has written with our friend Robert Bavall a new book, which will come out in the spring, called Origins of the Sphinx. That's one of the things we'll talk with him about today. Robert, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Welcome back.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on.
My gosh, you have been doing this for how many years now?
Well, 26 years. I guess it's officially the 26th year since I went to Egypt in 1990 for the first time.
Do you miss Zahi Hawass at all?
Oh, of course. We all miss him.
Does Robert even miss him?
And that doesn't mean you, how should we say, we want him back where he was.
The one thing I really liked about the guy is he made archaeological diggings around the pyramids and the Sphinx exciting.
He did make things exciting. Yeah. That's very true. And he is still in Egypt. He is still involved with the Ministry of Antiquities. He's just no longer the top person.
And they didn't take him away. I thought he was going to end up in jail for a while there.
Yeah, some of us thought that would occur. You know, that would occur. But what can I say? Egypt is like many places. Lots of unexpected things politically.
Yep, absolutely. No question about that. And didn't we talk a couple of years ago, we were talking about Edgar Cayce and the Hall of Records?
Sure.
And there's that, you folks found something there.
We found under the left paw of the Sphinx a chamber. We found that seismically. That was back in the early 1990s when Tom DeBecky, geophysicist, and myself were working there with seismic equipment, and we definitely found the chamber. I mean, when I say the chamber, a chamber under the left paw of the Sphinx, which is where Edgar Cayce predicted it would be. And to my knowledge, it has not been entered. It's not been, certainly not been excavated. So that's something I'd still like to pursue. I still want to pursue, and I'm hoping that we may make some progress in the near future.
Assuming Cayce was right and what you folks have been doing is correct, what do you think could be in there?
Well, Cayce, to put things in context, called it a hall of records. And he was, of course, tying it to his concept that Egypt was an inheritance from Atlantis. And we can talk about that, and I'm not a big, should we say, Atlantis hunter in the sense of trying to find where Atlantis was. For me, the primary lesson of Atlantis is that there was advanced civilization much earlier, and we now have very good, very strong evidence and data to support this, that there was civilization before what we call geologically the end of the last ice age, before 9700 BC. Now, if that chamber under the left paw is a remnant of that earlier civilization, which I think is quite possible given, and we talk about this in Origins of the Sphinx, Robert Bavall and myself, given all the evidence from all kinds of disciplines that the core body of the Sphinx, the origins of the Sphinx, go back to late Ice Age times, about 10,000 BC, there could be incredible information in that chamber.
There could be archaeological sketches.
There could be archaeological sketches. There could be artifacts. We just don't know. I really think it behooves us to explore it further.
Part of me thinks that Zahi, in the middle of the night, went down there. Is that possible?
It's It's not totally out of the realm of possibilities. Do I think that occurred? No, because it would be very complicated. It would be very complex to try to have entered it. Could he possibly have gone into the drilled into it somehow? Yes, it's not totally inconceivable because there is a cavity in the rump of the Sphinx, which is probably Greco-Roman, you know, a couple mm-hmm. thousand years old. But you can go into that, and theoretically one could go into there and maybe drill laterally to put a fiber optic camera into the chamber that we're talking about. Now, I doubt that that ever actually occurred because you'd need, you know, fairly sophisticated equipment. You'd have to get into a very small opening to get into that chamber, et cetera. I suspect it's just not been entered. It's just not been explored.
What are the dimensions of the chamber?
It's pretty large. It's about 9 by 12 meters based on our seismic analysis. So that is not insignificant whatsoever. Furthermore, based on our analysis, it has something in it. Now, one could argue, oh, it's just a collapsed roof. I don't think so. I think there are definitely artifacts and that type of thing.
Well, you know, it's basically then 27 feet by 36 feet. That's a huge room.
It's a big, yeah, it's big.
How deep down is it?
It's probably about 5 meters or so.
15 feet under.
The bedrock surface level of the Sphinx floor.
Did they build it to be covered up? Or did it just happen to, you know, be that way?
No, it is carved in solid bedrock. It may have been a natural cavity initially, which was often the case back
Which wasn't buried, right?
Well, it's in solid bedrock. I suspect, I think this is the answer to your question, there is a cliff face under the sand in front of the Sphinx Temple, which is just in front of the Sphinx. That cliff face is covered with meters and meters of sand at the moment, and I suspect that if we cleared out all that sand, we might find an entrance going laterally, horizontally into this chamber. So it may have been a natural cave in essentially a cliff that was then carved out and made into an artificial chamber. Or it could have been just an artificial chamber from the beginning.
Yeah.
But I suspect that the way they got into it was through that cliff face, which is now under, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 parts of the cliff face are, you know, over 12 meters of sand.
Well, and common sense tells you, Robert, if you build a chamber, you build it to put something in it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it would be the perfect place to store relics, to store artifacts, to store records
mm-hmm.
for time immemorial.
Oh, that's exciting. And wasn't the Sphinx at one time covered up almost to its eyes?
Yes. Well, maybe not its eyes, but certainly up to its chin. In fact, most of its history, when I say most of its history as a dynastic Sphinx, as Egyptian Sphinx, so the last 4,500 to 5,000 years, it has been covered up with sand. The body has been covered with sand up to its neck or chin. Now, before that, under a different climatic regime, before there was Sahara Desert, it was another story altogether.
Now, you wrote a book that's coming out in the spring called Origins of the Sphinx with Robert Bavall.
Correct.
Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, Origins of the Sphinx is real. Its focus is on the Sphinx, so I want everyone to understand that. And in many ways, to get the bigger picture, I see it as a complement to my previous book, Forgotten Civilization, which puts, you know, everything into a larger context. But I have been working on the Sphinx and the redating of the Sphinx, pushing the age of the Sphinx back. And when I say the age of the Sphinx, I'm talking about the origins of it,
mm-hmm.
really physically the core body, because the head is recarved. And I always like to stress that that is not the original head. It was probably a lion's head originally. That's
uh-huh.
my
right.
hypothesis. And, you know, Egyptologists, they repeat themselves over and over, and they say, oh, Shock is wrong because it's a dynastic head. Well, no, Shock is not wrong because it's a dynastic head. That is a new carving. That is a recarving of a, you know, stuck onto or recarving of a much more ancient statue.
And why would they have done that?
Oh, because the original head became incredibly weathered. I am convinced at this point, and we talk about this in great detail coming from a geological perspective, a seismic perspective. We talk about the mythology involved. We talk about the ancient religion of the dynastic Egyptians and their predecessors. All of the data comes together to indicate that the original Sphinx goes back to, we'll say, roughly 10,000 BC, just before, or at least there was something there just before the end of the last ice age. It may actually go back even further, but we can certainly place it at about 10,000 BC, the original core of the structure that we now call the Sphinx. It became incredibly weathered and eroded and was probably in fairly miserable shape, to use a colloquial term, in 3,000, 2,500 BC. So when you look at the Sphinx now, it is covered with repair blocks. The body is covered with repair blocks. That's not how it was originally constructed. Those repair blocks, even according to Zahi Hawassin, he's been very adamant about this, actually, some of them go back to Old Kingdom times, so well over 4,000 years ago.
Wow.
What they were doing is they were repairing a statue that was already thousands of years old.
And it was crumbling.
It was crumbling, exactly. Now, the head would have been in horrible shape also, but it would be much more difficult, I'm speaking as a geologist, to try to put little repair blocks all over the head and face. So apparently what they ended up doing, and I'm convinced of this, I have walked on the back of the Sphinx, I've looked at it up close, and you can see that they recarved the head. So they took a larger head. I speculate, for many good reasons that we talk about in the book, that it was a lion, and they recarved it. And when they recarved it, they may have actually recarved it more than once, but the final recarving that we see today is the human head.
They probably said, we can't restore it back to its original shape.
Correct.
It's down. We got to downsize it because it's crumbling.
Exactly.
And let's do this.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting, and I'm not the only one that said this, but when I first went to Egypt in 1990, when I first saw the Sphinx, one of the first things I noticed was that the head is proportionally too small for the body.
You're right about that. Does the face, in your opinion, Robert, represent anybody from that era?
I do not personally believe that it represents anyone that we can pinpoint. I suspect personally that the face is sort of a generic, even androgynous face, and it is an African face, to put it bluntly, you know, Nubian, if you want to call it that. Some people, the classic version is that represents the pharaoh Khafre. We have demonstrated, we did this back in the early 90s with Frank Domingo, who's unfortunately now deceased, but a forensic expert at the time. He was with the New York Police Department. He compared the face to the face of Khafre, which is what most of the Egyptologists say the comparison should be, and it's not the same face. It's not even the same ethnicity. Other people have said it's Khufu, the builder of the Great Pyramid. I'm not convinced by that. I think it's more of a generic face or an unidentified face.
Will the origins of the Sphinx rock anybody's belief system?
Oh, well, it's going to rock, yes, many people's belief systems. It's going to confirm some people's belief systems, but it's going to rock many people. And those many people include certain Egyptologists that are still holdouts that say this is all impossible despite the evidence and despite even Egyptological evidence, which we cite from the texts, the writings, the archaeology. It's going to rock them because many Egyptologists to this day, and I would say the majority, want to place the Sphinx in a time period of about 2500 BC. That's when it was carved, according to them, from scratch. They don't want to admit, they don't want to acknowledge the evidence that, yes, the dynastic Egyptians were using the Sphinx and incorporating it into their overall complex, but It's an older structure. It's an older statue that they revered, that they were holding sacred as an ancient relic.
How old do you think the Sphinx is?
12,000 years, at least. 10,000 BC.
That goes way back.
Yeah, way back. But again, remember, the head is not the original.
Right.
Head.
Now, the civilization at the time that built it, what kind of technology do you think they had?
I don't know what kind of technology. I mean, this is a difficult thing, but I can tell you it was a technology that had to have an incredible sophistication and incredible organizational abilities. I say that for a couple of reasons. Just to carve the Sphinx, or what we'll call the proto-Sphinx, again, the head's recarved, they did not simply go chip, chip, chip and carve out the rock, you know, crumble the excess rock and take it out in baskets. One thing people have to realize if they haven't been to Egypt is that the body of the Sphinx is below the natural surface level. So they actually carved down into solid rock to free the body of the Sphinx. To this day, the Sphinx sits in what is known as a Sphinx enclosure. So when you go to see the Sphinx, you will see that you have to basically look down sort of into a quarry, if you would, to see the body of the Sphinx. Now, when they carved out the body of the Sphinx, they didn't just chip away the rock into pieces with, you know, pickaxes, that type of thing, and haul it out in baskets. They carved out huge limestone blocks. We're talking about limestone blocks that weigh tens of tons, 50 tons, maybe.
Like the pyramids.
100 tons.
Like the pyramid blocks.
Yeah, like the pyramid. But actually, the blocks for the Sphinx that they carved out when they were carving the body of the Sphinx, on average, are much larger than the average blocks for the pyramids. So they carved out these huge blocks weighing tens of tons, and they moved them in front of the Sphinx to build what is now referred to as the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, to its just to the side of it, if you face the Sphinx just to
12,000 years ago they did all this.
Exactly. So actually, most people focus on the Sphinx and how magnificent the Sphinx is and how it's astounding that it goes back to such an early period. Even more astounding technologically is that at the same time, they were moving these huge blocks of limestone to construct the, we call them temples, we really don't know what they were, but to construct these temples or buildings in front of and just to the south of the Sphinx.
Robert, how in the world did they move those blocks?
That I don't know. I really don't know. Because the best cranes, the best technology that we have today would have a very difficult time doing it. The classic answer, and this is Egyptologists speaking, and they're putting it in the period of, you know, 4,500 years
right.
ago, not 12,000 years ago. They say, oh, they used lots of manual labor and ropes and pulleys. Part of the problem with that is, I don't think it's convincing anyway, but you have such small areas to work in. If you actually go there and look at how they move the blocks around, you don't have space for thousands of people to be pulling on ropes.
That's right.
Even hundreds of people. It's very close spacing, very close tolerances. So whatever they were doing was absolutely...
It's truly amazing. I'm going to ask you many more questions, Robert, when we come back. Robert Schock with us tonight. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him. Fascinating discussion about the Sphinx, origins of the Sphinx, celestial guardian of pre-Pharaonic civilization. It's due out in the spring. It's an amazing work that he did with Robert Bavall, and we're going to be back in a moment more with Robert Schock on Coast to Coast AM.
Join the Coast to Coast AM Facebook page with thousands of members. It's great for show updates and connecting with other fans. Go to facebook.com/coasttocoastam and click the like button.
Welcome back with Robert Schock, author of Origins of the Sphinx. He wrote it with Robert Bavall, comes out in the spring. Robert, I'm going to ask you this strange question. Is there a possibility that those who built the Sphinx 12,000 years ago might have had some extraterrestrial help.
Well, of course, there's a possibility. Now, do I advocate that possibility? No, but I'm certainly open to the possibility. And so what I'm saying is that I don't know, but my personal inclination is not to go there unnecessarily. Mm-hmm. And it's a real, and I'm not trying to evade the question.
No, I understand.
I'm not trying to evade the question, but I don't go to the extraterrestrial possibility unnecessarily. And despite all the issues and problems with how did they build it, how did they build these structures in front of it, these so-called temples, and the engineering aspects, I also don't think we have any direct, absolute evidence that there was extraterrestrial intervention at that time.
Is the Sphinx older than the Great Pyramids?
I personally think that the Sphinx is older than the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids, but I have to say that those structures that we see today, as the Great Pyramid, the Second Pyramid, the Third Pyramid, the three major pyramids, mm-hmm. are built on earlier sites. So the sites themselves, I believe, go back in terms of their sacredness, if you would, to the age of the Sphinx. Something that we talk about in Origins of the Sphinx is there seem to be two layers, if you would, two developmental layers or complexes on the Giza Plateau. The first complex in time, the earlier complex that goes back to this very early period, consists of the Sphinx, the temples associated with the Sphinx, and it was based on probably what we could call a solar religion or a solar cult, ties in with the sun, which is actually part of the bigger story, because this civilization, this early cycle of civilization, was decimated by the sun, by a major solar outburst. So they had a very strong interest in the sun, and we see this solar complex, if you would. Later, we see a stellar complex added to that, and this ties in with Robert Bouval's work on the Orion correlation.
Right.
The three pyramids tie in with the Belt of Orion, but all three of those pyramids, in my assessment, based on the evidence, based on the data, cover over or mark the sites of earlier structures. In fact, I believe embedded within each of the pyramids, if you would, there are earlier components, earlier structures. So again, we have the same situation as the Sphinx that the dynastic Egyptians were restoring, they were refurbishing, they were protecting, they were building over earlier sites.
How close geographically is the Sphinx in proximity to the Great Pyramids on Giza?
Oh, we're just talking hundreds of meters.
Oh, that's it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're all, it's a very small area. I mean, you know, it's big when you walk around.
Sure.
There, but geographically, it's all one area.
Are you leaning toward any specific rationale in terms of how they built the Sphinx, or are you simply saying you have no idea?
I will go with the latter. I am not an engineer. I know where my limits of expertise lie, and I have looked at, you can imagine, over the last 25 plus years, I've looked at many theories as to how they carved those huge blocks out and moved them. Because that's really what we're talking about.
How do you do that in tight
tolerances, blocks that weigh 50 or more tons and move them? And, you know, all the speculation with the ramps and pulleys, you know, that the Egyptologists talk about, it just doesn't work. I'm not convinced.
What about lost knowledge? What happened, Robert, to the knowledge of how did they build them? I mean, you would think they passed this on from generation to generation. There's got to be a gap somewhere.
Yeah, there's a huge gap, and that's an integral part of the story. That's a major issue that I think we need to look at and learn from. We have, this is my reconstruction of things, and I talk about this at some length in Forgotten Civilization. As I said, the two books in my mind really complement each other.
Yeah.
So much of this, people should look at Forgotten Civilization for this analysis and story. But essentially, we have what I call an early cycle of civilization at the end of the last ice age, reaches or was reaching a culmination at the end of the last ice age. We're talking roughly 10,000 BC. They were flourishing. They were building these incredible structures on the Giza Plateau in southeastern Turkey at Göbekli Tepe. And you and I have talked about Göbekli Tepe.
How about Balabak in Lebanon?
Yes. That's
same
probably
thing.
Part of it, too.
Yeah.
We have, for instance, Gunung Padang in Indonesia, which is probably part of this. So we have civilization around the world, I'm convinced, at a very high level before 9700 BC. 9700 BC is the pivotal date. That is when the ice age ends in a blink, literally, based on ice core data. The ice age ended literally overnight. We now have very good high-resolution data from Greenland ice cores, for instance, that shows it just happened in a snap. And I believe there was a major solar outburst that decimated the civilization at the time, caused incredible havoc. This is why so much was lost. Records were lost. You know, people died. I mean, it was terrible, and there were geological catastrophes that we can document that went with this. So essentially, this civilization or civilizations around the world were decimated in the blink of an eye, if you would. We went into a dark age, which we are calling the solar-induced dark age, or SIDA for short, S-I-D-A, solar-induced dark age. And humanity was in this essential dark age for thousands of years, from 9700 BC or thereabouts till about 3000, maybe 3500.
Wow. So that's
BC.
The gap, thousands
that
of years.
That is a huge gap. And the ancient civilizations of about 3500 to 3000 BC, you see those civilizations re-emerging in Egypt. So that's when dynastic Egypt solidifies. We see that in Mesopotamia, in Sumer, for instance. We see that a little later in the Indus Valley in China. But they are re-emergence of civilization. And they themselves, the dynastic Egyptians, for instance, in the Old Kingdom, they talked about an earlier, what I would call cycle civilization. They talked about earlier civilization, what they referred to as Zeptepi. That was a previous time, thousands of years earlier, when there was civilization on Earth. And they talked about this. They understood.
Gosh, to be there during this time and witness it, wouldn't that be amazing?
Oh, it would be amazing to witness. Very, man, catastrophic and cataclysmic. But it would have been amazing to witness it. And I wanted to say also, during that span of time, the SIDA, the solar-induced dark age, we have evidence that this is exactly what was going on, that there was this huge setback, essentially decline. So, for instance, we have a very famous site in Turkey known as Çatalhöyük, which is the height of civilization at that time, but this is during SIDA. So this is several thousand years after the end of the last ice age. They're not building with huge stone blocks. They're not building with stone at all. They've got a bunch of mud brick houses all clustered together.
What's amazing is that even logic can't give you an explanation of how they may have moved those stones.
No, exactly.
Those blocks.
Exactly, exactly. So I don't know what was happening with how they moved those stones. And you were mentioning the ET possibility, the extraterrestrial possibility. As I said, I can't rule that out, but I'm not inclined to go there either, because they may have had a technology, a way of doing things that has been lost.
Lost knowledge again.
Lost knowledge, and we just don't know what it was. And it may seem very simple in hindsight, or maybe not simple, but logical in hindsight, if we can rediscover it, either by figuring it out ourselves or maybe finding it in a hall of records or that chamber under
mm-hmm.
the Awe of the Sphinx, and we might say, aha, that's it, once we learn how they did it.
My unscientific mind here in this respect, Robert, is that they might have possessed some kind of sound resonance, or they understood magnetics somehow.
Absolutely.
And they were able to, in magnetics doesn't necessarily mean you have to be metal.
Right.
And they somehow were able to levitate these blocks with something.
Yeah, I think that is quite logical. In fact, I don't want to sound the wrong way, but I'm sure you remember it, Mystery of the Sphinx, the Mystery of the Sphinx.
Yeah.
The NBC documentary that I'm in, that goes way back. The 90s, but something that we tentatively threw out there, you know, just for heuristic value to get people thinking, was could they have used sound, somehow harnessed sound, to levitate these blocks? And when I say levitate, you know, maybe they weren't moving them exactly into position, but at least effectively reducing the weight of them.
Yeah, so almost where they became like anti-gravity or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not necessarily levitating like people think of a magic show and all, you know, goes and sits down exactly where it is, but essentially overcoming the force of gravity to a certain extent. And, you know, some people will poo-poo that and say that's crazy, but they're the same people that would have said cell phones are crazy, you know, 50 years ago.
That's right. I mean, I just got a Skype phone call during my last guest from Japan.
Yeah,
I mean, so there's a person on a train with their phone. It's a Skype call now. It's not even a phone call.
Wow.
And we're talking to them, and they're talking to my guest. Who would have thought that 20 years ago?
Exactly. Who would have thought that even just a couple of decades ago?
Just amazing. What is the possibility also when we talk about something might have happened, a comet, an asteroid, some kind of a strike that wiped out the civilization, did not damage the Sphinx, but wiped out the surrounding area?
Well, two things. One, and this is based on really looking at the evidence in great detail, and this is my field. I'm a geologist, and I have a degree in geology and geophysics. I'm not trying to sound high-handed. I'm just saying I have a background in these things. And in the past, when I say the past, back in the early 2000s when I was writing and whatnot, I speculated about a comet because we didn't really know what could have caused devastation to these early civilizations. And, you know, we didn't have as much information as we do now. I'm now convinced that it was a solar outburst, that all the evidence points to a solar outburst. There have been theories circulating recently in the last 10 years about a comet hitting the Earth, actually either hitting or exploding over what is now Canada, and that somehow that caused the end of the last ice age. That's not really correct. That hypothesized comet was 10,900 BC, not 9,700 BC. It has been hypothesized that that comet actually began what's known as the Younger Dryas, which was a 1,200-year cooling period before the very end of the last ice age. So it's a little complicated, people don't know about, but the end of the last ice age, for 1,200 years, it actually got a bit cooler on Earth, especially in the northern hemisphere. Then at 9,700 BC, you have this huge warming, instantaneous warming. So some people have suggested that there's evidence for a comet initiating the cooling period 1,200 years before the end of the last ice age. That's all fine and dandy with me. I actually don't mind either way, whether there was a comet or not. But when you look at the evidence very, very, very carefully for a comet hitting at that time or anywhere within that period, it evaporates. The evidence just does not hold up to scrutiny. And a lot of it is very, very technical. It has to do with things called nanodiamonds and whether they really exist and whether they really are found in the proper geological layers, and if they really are tied in with a comet or not, that type of thing. There was a paper, for instance, reviewing all the incredibly technical data published just a couple of weeks ago in one of the geological journals that reviewed all the latest data and came to the conclusion that essentially it does not hold up to scrutiny.
Roberts, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to mention one thing. It's interesting, though, a lot of the data actually has been misdated, and some of it actually is correctly dated when you look at it geologically, and it ties in with 9700 BC, and some of the same features it's now been demonstrated that people were using to claim a comet actually tie in with what you expect from a solar outburst, vitrification of rock, that type of thing.
Some 25 years ago, when you came out with the theory that the Sphinx was much older than what people thought at the time, you came under a lot of criticism. Why did people get so upset? Why don't they just simply say, okay, that's his work, that's his research, he could be right, and move on? But, I mean, it was almost like they hated you.
Oh, they did hate me. Certain people hated me. Now, this shows that there are real divisions in academia. There are real divisions in the sciences versus the humanities. And I don't want to sound nasty, but the Egyptologists are really not scientists. They're more in the art history, humanities area. And they were the ones who were so nasty about it, so vehement about it. They called me a pseudoscientist. They said that you know, I didn't know what I was talking about, that I was making things up. They said, oh, I just wanted publicity to be on the radio and television. it was really hilarious. In hindsight, it was not hilarious at the time for me. It was very disheartening. And what I found is that they did not like an insider, because I'm a geologist. I'm trained as a geologist. I've done a lot of Egyptology now, of course, over the last 25 years, but my PhD is geology and geophysics. One Egyptologist, very senior person at a conference, even came up to me and said that, you know, there's a lot of rocks out there in the world. You better go look at some rocks other than in Egypt if you know what's good for you. They did not like me coming in and, as they saw it, overturning their theories.
Just an amazing work that you've done.
I mean,
and
I think it's really
done.
Sociological and political more than anything else. The geologists have always agreed with me, my geological colleagues, when I presented at geological conferences and so forth.
You were back in Egypt recently. Anything new out there?
Yes. One thing that's very exciting, among other things, is that on the Giza Plateau, we've now located, and this was pointed out to me by a couple of Egyptian colleagues, actually, because I like to give credit where credit's due, Mohammed Ibrahim and Yosef Alyan. They pointed out to me something that I probably walked over numerous times before, but you sometimes don't see things when you're not specifically looking for them and you're looking for other things and you're focusing on other things. They pointed out to me on the Giza Plateau, just at the base of the second pyramid, a place where the rock, the bedrock, not just surface rock, but the bedrock going down deep for numerous meters, because you can see this in certain places where the ancients cut into the bedrock to make pits and whatnot, where the rock looks charred and burnt. What this is, I believe, and I'm going to be studying this further, I believe this is actually where plasma hit, electrical discharges hit.
That's that solar burst again, isn't it? Right there. Stay with us, Robert. We're going to come back. We'll talk more about your incredible work. And, of course, we'll take phone calls on Coast to Coast AM.